So this is the third lecture in the series Maintaining Orthodoxy in the New World. Thank you for coming. We're going to talk about the period 1800 to 1880. Why do I stop at 1880? Because beginning in 1881, that began the huge migration of Jews from Eastern Europe to America. And that went from 1881 to about 1924, when immigration was effectively shut off. As Herb mentioned, Yosef Goldman, who is a friend of mine, and who has, I believe, the most extensive collection of materials related to American Jewish history in the world, one more time, in the world, has agreed to have a small exhibition of some things that are related to the talk and some things that are related to American Jewish history. That will take place downstairs after the lecture. Who are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about Jacob Mordechai. We're going to talk about Naftali and Josephine Phillips, those who were here last time. The Phillips name rings a bell, hopefully. A gentleman by the name of Warder, W-A-R-D-E-R, Cresson, Isaac Leeser, Rabbi Avram Rice, the battle of Orthodoxy with Reform Judaism, a little bit about Jews in the Civil War, Grant's expulsion order of the Jews during the Civil War, and an unusual gentleman, Rabbi Chaim Zvi Schneerson, whose picture I handed out. We're going to begin with Jacob Mordechai. Jacob Mordechai is born in 1762. He died in 1838. He was a pioneer in women's education. During the latter part of the 18th century and in the 19th century, women were rarely given anything more than a basic education at home. They certainly were not given an academic education in general. In fact, it was felt that women could not handle an academic education, and this was just not done. But Jacob Mordechai proved that not only could they handle it, but one could do really interesting things with women's education. Those of you who have heard of the Beis Yaakov movement perhaps think wrongly that Sarah Schneerson is the one who started women's education in the world, Jewish education. It ain't true. It's not true at all. Rav Hirsch had in his school special classes for women, and in fact in 1840 somebody told me he wrote a letter to somebody in Poland, a rabbi in Poland, telling him how to set up a girls' school. I don't know if it ever took place. I don't think it did. In any case, so Sarah Schneerson did, though, do a great deal for Jewish education. Jacob Mordechai, though, is not in Jewish education per se, but in secular education. Jacob Mordechai was the son of Moses and Esther Mordechai. Now, those who were here on Friday night, we spoke about Esther Elizabeth Whitlock Mordechai, who was a Gioris, who, when her husband Moshe passed away, Jacob I. Cohen, who was a Kohen, wanted to marry her, but he couldn't do it. He wasn't supposed to do it because she was a Gioris, according to Kent Merrick, Gioris. They lived in Philadelphia at the time that they wanted to get married, and the presidium of the synagogue in Philadelphia, Mikveh Yisrael, said absolutely no, told the chazan no, told them they couldn't have the shul, but nonetheless they went ahead and did marry, and we have that ksuva, and as I pointed out last time, one of the witnesses on that ksuva is a gentleman named Chaim Solomon. Little footnote, an interesting little footnote. In any case, Moses and Esther Mordechai, they were observant Jews. In 1760, they came from Germany to Philadelphia, and Jacob, Yaakov, was born in 1762. He attended private schools and received a classical education. At age 13, Jacob served as a rifleman when the Continental Congress was resident in Philadelphia and later helped supply the Continental Army as a clerk to David Franks, the Jewish quartermaster to George Washington. Jews were very involved. Those Jews who were here were involved in the revolution, those who supported it. After the war, Jacob Mordechai moved to New York and he married Judith Myers. In 1792, Judith and Jacob moved to a place called Warrenton, Virginia, a little hole in the wall, but located in the crossroads linking Richmond, Charleston, and Savannah, major communities. It's worth noting, by the way, that despite the fact that the Mordechais were the only Jewish family in and around this small town, they remained observant Jews, keeping a strictly kosher home where Shabbos was observed during all of the years that they lived there. Judith died at the time of the birth of their seventh child, so Jacob married Rebecca Myers, the younger half-sister of Judith. Now, Jacob was a tobacco merchant originally, but he wasn't particularly interested in business. He had attained an excellent knowledge of the Hebrew language and literature. He studiously devoted himself to literary pursuits, especially biblical research, and wrote many articles based on these intellectual pursuits. And indeed, later you will be able to see one of the writings of Jacob Mordechai downstairs. That's one of the things that Yossi is going to bring.
Lower level, please.
Lower level, okay. His business failed. He was in a financial dilemma of what to do. And in 1808, which is just about the time that his business failed, the local residents offered to support an academy for girls if he would be its headmaster. In 1809, the school opened with 30 students and ended up being a family project. By the way, not Jewish girls necessarily. Anyone. In the beginning, Jacob and Rebecca taught all the classes. There were no textbooks. There was nothing suitable. Everything had to be produced almost from scratch. However, soon they were joined in the classroom by their daughter, Rachel. Rachel played a key role in the school. She was educated at home by her parents. She was a well-educated woman. And in later years, by two of their sons. The younger Mordechai children helped with the cooking and care of the dormitories. The only instructor in the academy who was not a member of the family was the music teacher. The school's curriculum was not limited to academics. It also stressed proper manners and demeanor. Students were subjected to considerable personal discipline and a highly structured day during which they were kept constantly busy. This was unusual. This was unheard of for women. High standards of behavior and performance were the norm for both students and faculty. The goal was to properly mold both the character and intellectual development of the students. See, secular education at one time was, lahavdil, in a certain sense, close to yeshiva education. After all, what is the purpose of yeshiva education? Not just to shove a huge amount of knowledge down the throat of the student, but also to mold the student, to help him develop his midos or her midos and character. And the same was true for secular education at one point. Today, it's absolutely not true. Today, there's no attention virtually paid to this sort of thing in most colleges. But in those days, it was not so uncommon. So, to foster this, the molding of the character and the intellectual development, the headmaster and his staff carefully and regularly checked on the girls' character development. Jacob made sure that the students attended the church of their choice. There were times when he even went with them to the quote-unquote preaching, as he called it. He was careful to avoid all doctrinal and sectarian discussions in school activities. Nonetheless, at the same time, he provided opportunities for all of his students to discuss philosophical and ethical issues. This was done using classical texts with the goal of sharpening the girls' critical faculties so that they would become aware of important moral and ethical considerations. Such an approach was unique for girls, in fact, unheard of, since these subjects were usually studied only in schools for men at the time. Jacob Mordechai stressed that piety in any religious tradition was an important part of character development. Interestingly enough, the Mordechais also included the observance of Jewish holidays in the academy's educational program. Since all of the Mordechai children, male and female, attended and or worked in the school, as well as several cousins, there was a critical mass of Jewish students to observe holidays. At the same time, Jacob encouraged the Christian students at the academy to observe their own religious holidays. To him, it mattered little what religious practices his students observed, just so long as they were respectful of the religious preferences of others. There were discussions of philosophical texts that raised moral and ethical issues that all students could deal with regardless of their religious differences. The school was a phenomenal success. Unbelievable. Started with 30 students in 1809. By 1814, he had a shut-off enrollment at 110. Couldn't handle anymore. In 1819, he sold the school and he moved to Richmond. Now, why did he sell the school? It was a phenomenal success. It was at the height of success. Because he saw what was happening as a result of the Jewish isolation within which he lived. One of his daughters ended up marrying the non-Jewish music instructor. Others of his children also converted, etc. He moved to Richmond, but unfortunately it was too late. He purchased a farm and he lived as an active member of Richmond's Jewish community, serving as the president of its congregation, Kehillah Kodesh Beth Shalmei. Jacob died in 1838. This is an interesting now little vignette. One of his grandsons provides us with an insight into the enduring impact which the education given at the academy had on its students. When he visited Jacob's then elderly widow, Rebecca Myers Mordechai, he was impressed by the respect shown her by a former student. Quote, "One scene is vividly recalled when Mrs. John Y. Mason, formerly Miss Fort, who was shortly to sail for France with her husband, then minister to that country, called to say farewell to my grandmother. Mrs. Mason was moved to tears and, kneeling down, begged for a blessing. Mrs. Mordechai was then a silvery-haired widow, worn and aged, and in a solemn and touching way she laid her trembling hands upon the lady's head and pronounced the priestly benediction of our race." Jacob Mordechai was influential, like most major role models, because of his strong personality and his determined activities. At a critical point in history, he inspired women to attain a level of education which had been denied them and motivated some of them, like his children, to become teachers, writers, and advocates for his cause. He succeeded in part because he located his school strategically to attract many of the daughters of the leading families of the South, and he used his extended family as social contacts as well as his curriculum to attract abilities to attract them to his school. He used his knowledge, administrative abilities, and his children to encourage his female students to attain a level of intellectual proficiency and professional achievement which had previously been reserved only for men. He was a groundbreaker, ladies and gentlemen. He was a groundbreaker. But the story of his family and the Myers family and another family, the Hayes family, that's intertwined with them, is a disaster Jewishly. There is a book that, of course, my friend Yossi Goldman has. So when I was looking for it, I called him up. "Oh, yeah, come and get it." He says, I got it. And in it, somebody writes in 1910 or 12 or 13, there are only 5 Jewish members left from the entire family. Only 5 Jewish members. Terrible. Now we come to somebody who I doubt many people have heard of, a gentleman by the name of Warder Cresson, WarderCresson. He went from Quaker to Shaker to Orthodox Jew. It's an unbelievable story, an unbelievable story. We know, of course, of certain converts, Yisro, Rus, Novi Avadia, Onklus, others. Why is his name Warder? Because his mother's maiden name was Warder, W-A-D-E-R, and he was named that, obviously, to preserve the name. And Cresson, C-R-E-S-S-O-N. He was born on July 13, 1798, to John Elliot Cresson and Mary Nay Warder. They were a prominent Quaker family. At 17, he went to work on the family farms, and at 23, he married and became a successful farmer. He was well-to-do. But he began to question the fundamental tenets of Quakerism. He felt there was too much form and not enough substance. So he broke with the faith of his fathers, and by the 1840s, he had become, in turn, a Shaker, a Mormon, a Seventh-day Adventist, and a Campbellite. I don't know what a Campbellite is. I didn't bother to look, but obviously it's some sect. Well, the latter two, what?
Drank a lot of soup.
The latter two denominations believed that the second coming of Christ was close at hand. He also became notorious in Philadelphia for religious haranguing in the streets, where he warned all within earshot of an approaching apocalypse. He would corner people, he would sort of stand on a soapbox, and he would yell and scream. He became acquainted with Isaac Lisa, whom we will also talk about, in about 1840, and Mordechai Manuel Noah, who we won't talk about, but he deserves to be talked about. Both Lisa and Noah were convinced that Jews would soon return to Palestine to live in their former national homeland. This was well before Zionism, well before Herzl. By 1844, Crescent became convinced that God was about to gather the Jewish people in Jerusalem as a prelude to the, quote, end of days, unquote. He wrote, quote, God must choose some medium to manifest and act through in order to bring about his designs and promises in this visible world. This medium or recipient is the present poor, despised, outcast Jews. God is about gathering them again in Jerusalem. He decided he had to move to Yerushalayim to personally witness this great event. So he writes in a book. He wrote a number of books. This book is called The Key to David, Key of David, and it's actually available on the internet because it was on a Jewish site. And if you look at the because I put up also the outline that I used to make the talk. If you look there, you can find the website. In the spring of 1844, he wrote, I left everything near and dear to me on earth. I left the wife of my youth and six lovely children, dearer to me than my natural life, and an excellent farm with everything comfortable around me. I left all these in pursuit of truth and for the sake of Torah alone. Truth, for the sake of truth alone. He also did something else before he left. He contacted two influential congressmen, and he said he was willing to serve as the American consul to Jerusalem at no charge, no cost. He would do it freely. And he was appointed, lo and behold, the American consul to Jerusalem. And he left with an American flag and a dove, and he was off. He was off. However, when other people found out about it, thinking that he was a nut, they had his appointment rescinded, but he didn't know about it for 6 months. So for 6 months he served in Jerusalem as the American consul. American consul. He ended up converting to Judaism. Now this is something that is unheard of at this time.
What year was that?
We're going to get there. During the next 4 years, Warder found himself being increasingly attracted to the Jews of Jerusalem and at the same time developing more and more doubts about his Christian beliefs. Finally, quote, denying the divinity of Jesus after noting the contradictions in the Gospels, Crescent was ready for the most drastic step of his incredible journey. I remained in Jerusalem in my former faith until the 28th day of March, 1848. He wrote, when I became fully satisfied that I could never obtain strength and rest, but by doing as Ruth did, and saying to her mother-in-law, or Naomi, quote, he means the Jewish church, quote unquote, entreat me not to leave thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. In short, upon the 28th day of March, 1848, I was circumcised, entered the Holy Covenant, and became a Jew. Crescent was then 49 years old. He took the name Michael Boaz Israel. Of course, he has a wife back in Philadelphia. He has children back in Philadelphia. Now, he's been writing to them regularly, and he decides now it's time to go home, and he was quite sure that when he met with his wife again, that he would easily convince her to convert to Judaism and the whole family. He was absolutely positive. There was no question. No question. So he began his return home on May 7, 1848, confident he would convince his wife and children to also adopt Judaism. However, his wife had become a committed Episcopalian in the meantime, and when he got to Philadelphia, she would hear none of it. His children were also opposed. But more than that, His wife had been given his power of attorney in his absence, and she had sold the family farm as well as most of his personal effects. In short, he was absolutely penniless. He had left a well-to-do man, and now he had virtually nothing. He tried to resolve his differences with his family in a peaceful way, but they wouldn't hear of it. His wife decided he must be crazy. And indeed, the wife and some other family members lodged a charge of lunacy against him. They got together something called the sheriff's jury, which is something in which you take six people and you can then get them to say such and such and such and such. And he was issued a very, they said he was crazy. He was never committed, though. Well, Warder wasn't the kind of guy to take anything easily lying down. So he sued in court. He appealed the verdict, and a trial on the charge of lunacy began on May 13th, 1851. And this was one of the classic trials of the 19th century. Now, let's understand what's at stake here. If he had converted to Catholicism or something else, it's doubtful that his family would have had him declared crazy. The fact that he had converted to Judaism was what made them convinced that he was crazy. And the issue here is a fundamental issue of religious freedom. Does a person have the right to convert to whatever religion he or she wants? And they were essentially challenging that. At the heart of Crescent's defense was his claim that in addition to his family's desire to seize his financial resources, was their opposition to his conversion to Judaism. They were sure that anyone who converted from Christianity to Judaism had to be insane. Thus, at the heart of the case was the question of whether a man was free to choose his religious affiliation. Over 100 witnesses testified. His wife's lawyer's accusations were numerous. Creason had joined various sects such as the Shakers, Millerites, Mormons, Irvingtons, and Campbellites before departing for Palestine to become a Jew. Before every election, he would prophesy a war, and he refused to vote since he thought that no president should rule. He harangued the people in the streets and upon one occasion walked with some friends around a house, it was not clear whose house, and lacking ram's horns, shouted in an effort to make the walls fall down. He informed Dr. Ramsey, a Presbyterian clergyman, that he saw in Jerusalem the embalmed body of King David. He claimed the 10 lost tribes were in Africa and that he had acquired evidence while in Germany that the Savior was a Negro. He applied epithets to the Savior and his mother, which we cannot here relate. He took to Jerusalem an American flag and a white dove and insisted when receiving his commission as consul at the State Department that he would now be a doorkeeper in the house of the Lord. All of this was fabricated. All of this was nonsense. Absolute nonsense. There were altogether 73 witnesses called by Creason's lawyers, including outstanding physicians who testified that he was sane, many prominent members of the Jewish community, including some notable national figures such as Mordechai Manuel Noah of New York. By the way, you will be able to see downstairs a letter that Creason wrote to Isaac Leeser. But surely the most unusual defense witness was Colonel Peter A. Brown, described as a man ardently devoted to the pursuits of science, exploring an almost untrodden tract of experimental investigation. What was Brown up to? Brown claimed that he had analyzed thousands of the samples of hair from people's heads. And he claimed that by looking at the hair and the shape of the follicle, he could tell you whether the person was sane or insane. This was considered first-rate science. The newspapers lapped it up. And he claimed for sure, based on the hair sample, that Creason was indeed sane. There was no question. And it was considered powerful testimony. Powerful testimony. Says something about science, doesn't it? Now, I'm a mathematician, so I'm kind of immune from this. Mathematics remains essentially constant through the ages, but science certainly changes. Ultimately, Creason was vindicated of all charges. The Philadelphia newspapers were almost unanimous in their praise of the results of the trial. They emphasized the issue of religious freedom, noting that Warder Creason was perhaps fickle, quote-unquote, and, quote, of unsteady disposition, unquote, in his choice of sects. They quickly added that it was his conversion to Judaism and the anger which this caused the family that precipitated the suit. quote, if he had become a Roman Catholic, they would probably have acquiesced. They could permit him to become a Shaker, a Millerite, or a Mormon, but when he became a Jew, all confidence in his sanity was lost. That's a quote from one of the local newspapers. Well, while he stayed then for 4 years in Philadelphia. He davened at Congregation Mikveh Yisrael, which is Isaac Lisa's synagogue. In fact, it was the only synagogue. He lived according to halacha. And he attempted again, maybe he hoped that his wife would see the light, but she didn't. Eventually, he divorced his wife Elizabeth, and in 1852, he returned to the Holy Land. He became even more convinced that Jews would soon return to the land of Israel. Now, this is an idea that nobody, Mordechai Emanuel Noah was one, a few others believed. Jews go back to Eretz Israel? Unheard of. Never happened. Absolutely not. He felt that a necessary precursor to this was the development of agricultural endeavors by Jews. As a result, he proposed a sophisticated plan for the establishment of Jewish agricultural settlements. Keep in mind, he's a farmer. He knows what he's talking about. He's a proto-Zionist. He's way before any of these ideas.
What year was this?
This is in 1852 that he returned. First Zionist Congress is in 1890-something, right? 1897. Who was the only American representative who went to that? Rabbi Dr. Shepsel Schaffer. Next lecture. In 1885, he acquired a tract of land near Jaffa with the intention of putting his plans into practice. However, his planned model farm never developed due to insufficient financial support. In the mid-1850s, he married Rachel Moliano and became an honored member of Jerusalem's Sfarda community. They had two children, David Ben Sion and Abigail Rus. Neither child lived to adulthood. Warder died on October 27, 1860, and was buried on the Mount of Olives with such honors as are paid only to prominent rabbis. His unusual life encompassed the almost unheard-of step of converting to Judaism, the issue of religious freedom, and the effect of natural movements upon Jews that eventually led to changes in their social and economic conditions. And now a little footnote. Herman Melville. Where does Herman Melville come into this story? Herman Melville believed, he's 1819 to 1891, he's the author of Moby Dick. I don't think, do they allow them to read that in yeshiva today or not? I don't know what they allow them to read. It's not an art scroll book, sorry about that. Yeah. And then, at one point, Melville looked to Palestine as the source of human experience and a possible hope for the future. He went so far as to borrow money in order to go to Palestine. There, in January 1856, he met Cresson. But the trip shattered Melville's illusions. Palestine seemed to him a symbol of a dying world rather than nativity. Quote, in the emptiness of the lifeless antiquity of Jerusalem, Melville wrote in his journal, the migrant Jews are like flies that have taken up their abode in a skull. Cresson's theories on agriculture he quickly dismissed. Quote, the idea of making farmers of the Jews is vain. In the first place, Judea is a desert, with few exceptions. In the second place, the Jews hate farming, and besides, the number of Jews in Palestine is comparatively small. And how are the hosts of them scattered in other lands to be brought here? Only by a miracle. About Cresson, he noted in his journal, Warder Cresson of Philadelphia, an American turned Jew, divorced from former wife, married a Jewess, etc., sad. It's clear that Cresson and Palestine affected Melville deeply. Indeed, they did. Out of his impressions of the journey emerged a long spiritual poem, The Clarol, a poem in pilgrimage in the Holy Land. Nathan, a Christian turned Jew, one of the leading characters of this unusual work, was obviously patterned after Cresson. Melville could not believe that Jews would ever return to Eretz Israel and turn it into a country where agricultural endeavors thrived. Cresson was convinced that this would happen. History has shown who was correct.
So they wrote a book about Cresson.
He wrote plenty of books.
From Shaker to Shuckler.
Now we're going to turn to Naftali and Josephine Phillips. We spoke about the Phillips family last Friday night, about Rebecca Mikado Phillips, and Jonas Phillips, Rebecca Mikado. is unusual for many, many things, but first of all, she gave birth to 21 children, 16 of whom survived. She also raised two of her grandchildren. One of them was Mordechai Emanuel Noah and his sister. In any case, Naftali Phillips is the ninth child of Rebecca Mercado and Jonas Phillips, and he was born in New York on October 19, 1773. Young Naftali became interested in journalism, and his first job was with the American Advertiser, a leading Philadelphia newspaper. On September 16, 1796, he personally took from the press of that journal the first printed copy of Washington's farewell address. By the way, the Phillips family are observant. Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus, they're observant people. Observant people. He moved to New York in 1801. He married. He became active in Sherith Israel. In fact, he served for 14 terms as president. It's a long, long time to be president. One of his daughters is a woman by the name of Josephine Phillips, 1814 to 1896. She was either the sixth or the seventh child to be born to Rachel and Naftali Phillips. Why do I say the sixth or seventh? Because she was a twin, and we don't know whether the other one was born first or not. We don't know whether Yocheved was born before Josephine or Josephine before Yocheved. Anyway, she was deeply affected by Lincoln's assassination on April 15, 1865, and wrote a moving letter to her brother-in-law, and we have that letter. We have that letter, and I'm going to read a little bit from it. Her letter, written only 5 days after Lincoln's death, expresses her profound grief. The significance of the letter quoted below lies not so much in its confirmation of historical data as in the fact that it was a typical personal outpouring of grief that was shared by untold numbers of other Jews. New York, April 20th, 1865. Now I'm going to read it the way she wrote it. So some of the English is not maybe what's proper, but this is the way she wrote it. Dear Adolphus, that's her brother-in-law. I received your letter last Monday and presume you also got mine containing our mutual sorrow and horror at the sad event that has plunged all in profound grief. Never in history has any event in any nation brought forth such real regret, and the loyalty of the people, high and low, rich and poor, is seen mingled with love and veneration for the man, quote, whose heart was warm, whose hands were pure, whose doctrine and whose life coincident exhibit lucid proof that he was honest in the sacred cause, and to such are rendered more than mere respect. These lines from Cowper, he's a certain poet, are forcibly brought to my recollection as illustrating much of the character of lamented president. New York is literally clad in black, and it is more rare to see a house without it than with it. From the splendid mansion to the smallest shanty, even the gates of the poorest black or white display their emblem of sorrow. Full well I can imagine how badly you feel. It was only last week you wrote me about your being at his house, because her brother-in-law Adolphus lived in Washington, and seeing him come out and request the band to play Dixie, and today that he appointed to celebrate our victories, his own funeral takes place. I have not yet recovered from the shock of last Saturday. Yesterday we had shul and a very large assemblage. The services were very solemn. The taba, that's actually the reader's desk, was covered with black, and also the pillars and gallery. Today, we have it again at 3 o'clock. Nothing is thought or talked of today. No stores are opened, and the poorest person will not work. I see by the paper the body will be here on Monday. His poor wife and children, what a sad change for them. I am truly glad Mr. Seward and son will recover, and also that his assassin is arrested, but it seems strange. Booth has yet eluded the vigilance of the police. His mother, I hear, resides in 19th Street, New York, and is, of course, in the greatest affliction. What a villain he is, Josephine. Then she added, the morning paper mentions the fact of the synagogues being the first places of worship that had prayers for the president. The Jews were shattered. The Jews were shattered in the north. Josephine never married. Now, I'm going to read to you a letter that was written to Abraham Lincoln by a gentleman from Narrowsburg, New York, His son was in the Union Army, and Lincoln had issued an edict saying that soldiers are allowed to have Sunday as a day of rest. But the gentleman who wrote this letter, he was Shomer Shabbos, and he had brought up his son to be Shomer Shabbos, and he wanted Lincoln to issue another edict allowing soldiers to have off whatever day of rest they chose. He wrote, "Now I stand before you as your namesake Abraham stood before God Almighty in days of yore and asked, shall not the judge of all earth do justice? So I ask your excellency, the first man and president of all the United States, shall you not do justice? Shall you not give the same privilege to a minority of the army that you give to the majority of it? I beseech you to make provision and to proclaim in another order that also all those in the army who celebrate another day as the Sunday may be allowed to celebrate that day which they think is the right day according to their own conscience. And this will be exactly lawful as the Constitution of the United States ordains it. And at the same time it will be exactly according to the teachings of the Bible as recorded in Leviticus 19 verse 18, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Interesting that we don't know whether Lincoln ever responded. I don't think he did. I don't know if he issued a second edict. Just don't know. Let's move on now to Isaac Leeser, 1806 to 1868. If one were to ask, who during the 19th century was the one person most responsible for perpetuating traditional Judaism in America, the answer must be Isaac Leeser. It's L-E-E-S-E-R. Leeser translated both the Sephardic and Ashkenazic versions of the Siddur into English. He's before Art Scroll. He's well before Art Scroll. Okay, in 1843, he started the Occident and American Jewish Advocate. That was a monthly journal in both English and Hebrew, the first American periodical published in America. He founded the Jewish Publication Society of America, the Board of Delegates of American Israelites, and Maimonides College. He tried to found a rabbinical college in Philadelphia. It was a failure, but he wanted to do it. He sought to transfer the lectern into the pulpit, and on June 2, 1830, delivered the first English sermon at Philadelphia's Congregation Mikveh Yisrael. You have to understand something which we talked about in the first lecture, but let's mention it again. There were no ordained rabbis who stayed in America until 1840. We will talk about Abraham Rice soon. But the first ordained rabbi to come, Orthodox rabbi to come to America and stay here, was Rabbi Avraham Rice. Until then, there were chazonim. There were learned balabatim. There were businessmen who had some Torah knowledge, but there were no rabbonim. Nobody to Paskin Ashila, really. Nobody. And the purpose of the chazon was to lead the davening, to lead the services. And the idea that he might deliver a speech and try to inspire the people with something was unheard of. And Leeser decided that that's what he was going to do. He was a groundbreaker in this. And he was opposed tooth and nail. And sadly enough, some of the Phillipses were opposed to him. And he fought and fought and fought with them. In any case, Isaac Leeser was born on December 12, 1806, in the tiny rural village of Neuenkirchen, near Rhine, Westphalia, in Prussia, into a family of humble means. His father died in 1820 when he was 14. After attending a traditional cheder as a boy, Leeser studied at the Gymnasium, the University of Münster, where he obtained a secular education. In addition, he studied some Gemara with private tutors. However, his Jewish education was not particularly substantial, and he readily admitted that he was not a great Talmudist. Indeed, he once wrote, "I had not the best opportunities of acquiring Jewish knowledge." There were few opportunities for him in Europe, and so he decided that he would come to America. He had a well-to-do uncle in Richmond, Virginia. He immigrated to America, and he worked for 5 years in Virginia for the uncle. And then he was appointed because he had written, a convert from Judaism to Christianity had written a scandalous attack on the Jews, and Leeser published a rebuttal that made him quite famous, And when it was, when he was told, and when they were told that they were, that Mikveh Yisrael, the congregation in Philadelphia, was looking for a chazan, somebody proposed Lisa, and he was appointed. He served as chazan from 1829 until 1850. His career there was stormy. Given his unflattering appearance and abrasive personality, Yossi Goldman said, I'm not going to bring a picture because he doesn't look nice. He doesn't look so nice. Okay, he was a short man. He was pockmarked. He had big, thick glasses. He didn't see well. Given his unflattering appearance and abrasive personality, it's not surprising he did not enjoy friendly relations with the members of the synagogue. He was often embroiled in battles with the congregants regarding his salary and contracts. Now, of course, that doesn't happen today. We know that that's all in the past. It's good that we've learned from American history, and we've learned, you know, all the good things. Lisa was the most outstanding figure in the movement to strengthen Jewish life in America. His activity on behalf of Judaism spanned almost the entire second period of Jewish immigration. There was the initial Jewish immigration here in the 17th century, and then in the 18th century, in the first half, there was immigration from Germany, when Jews began to come here, and then later, beginning in 1881, that's when masses came from Eastern Europe. He can be credited with assuring the survival of Judaism in America while the community expanded from a few thousand individuals living in the major coastal cities to about 200,000 living in cities and towns across the country. Although Lisa lived in Philadelphia for most of his life, he was not a local leader. All of America was his field of operation, and communities from all over the country turned to him for help and guidance. Unlike any other contemporary Jewish clergyman in America or in Europe, Lisa contributed to every aspect and stage of a Jew's life from childhood to old age. He was a pioneer preacher, publisher, Jewish educator. He believed in day school education. He tried to found a day school in Philadelphia. Nobody wanted to send their kids. They thought it was ridiculous. Public school was the place to go. He, as I mentioned earlier, tried to found and did found something called Maimonides College, but it never went anywhere. The spectrum of Lisa's activities involved more than preaching, publishing, and education. He had a genuine concern for the poor and downtrodden. He was instrumental in the founding of a Jewish foster home and a Jewish hospital in Philadelphia and organized the city's Jewish relief work. Isaac Lisa was a difficult man to whom people were not naturally attracted. Often he was defensive and argumentative, and his short stature, poor vision, and smallpox-scarred face did little to endear him to others. He never married and basically lived a hard, lonely life. He had little more than his work on behalf of American Jewry. Nonetheless, Isaac Lisa was a remarkable human being. He was indefatigable in his drive to make Judaism flourish in the United States. He taught American Jews that they could be leaders in the wider Jewish world. He managed to influence the development of nearly every aspect of Jacksonian and antebellum Jewish life in the United States, to the point where Henry Samuels Morris' observation that, quote, the history of American Judaism and that of Isaac Lisa are one and the same, cannot be dismissed as hyperbole, but is, in a very significant way, an accurate assessment of the American Jewish experience from the day Lisa first led a religious service in Mikveh Yisrael in 1829 to his death in Philadelphia in 1868. He was in the forefront of everything Jewish. Everything. He fought with reform. By the way, you have to understand something, ladies and gentlemen. The demarcation, the lines between reform and orthodox were not clear cut at a certain point in our history. The same, by the way, is with conservative Judaism. They were not clear cut. Reform looked very much, in certain cases, like orthodox Judaism. They just, in the beginning, wanted to change a little bit here, a little bit there. And Lisa at one point thought that maybe he could work out some sort of an agreement, some sort of, they could come to some sort of an understanding and remain as one Jewish group. But soon he realized that it was impossible, that the reformers were on their way to getting rid of all halacha, and so he fought them. He believed that America was a place where Jews and Judaism could flourish. Didn't believe it was a Trefa Medina like they told everybody in Europe. Didn't believe it. And that an exciting orthodoxy could be created here. Where many others saw only gloom and doom, he saw hope and success. He was certain that the laxity in Jewish religious practice so prevalent during the 19th century could be overcome if American Jews would only develop the proper organizations to meet the challenge of the times. It's worth reading about. Worth reading about. We're just doing highlights. We're not, I could be here for 2 years if we talked about everything in detail, and so we're not. Now we come to Rabbi Avraham Reis, 1802 to 1862. He's a classically educated Rav. He studied with Rabbi Avraham Bing in Würzburg. We mentioned him also last time. And received smicha from him. He also studied Rabbi Wolf Hamburger in Firth. These are German gedolim. According to some, he had a wooden leg, had a peg leg, and hence the German government would not let him become a rabbi in Germany. So he came to America, hoping to find a congregation in America. He first went to Newport in the hope that he could revive the Newport Jewish community, but it was impossible, and he ended up being called to a pulpit in Baltimore's Hebrew congregation. They were German Jews, he was a German Jew, it was a perfect match, everything looked hunky-dory. But it wasn't. It wasn't. Because reform was in the air. And shortly after he came, he began to battle with them. And he saw, first of all, that most of them did not keep Shabbos. And Kashrus also. In fact, he found total chaos in the Baltimore Jewish community. He initially made a stance, no one who was not Shomer Shabbos can be a voting member of the shul. They threw that out. By the way, that saved Cheret Israel in Baltimore. If you read the article that's in this past week's Hamodia magazine about Rabbi Schwab coming to Baltimore, which I had a little bit to do with, you'll see that that was an important thing in Baltimore, that the shul didn't change that ruling. Rabbi Schwab wouldn't let it change. Anyway, after battles and battles and battles with the people in the congregation, he left the congregation in 1849. He opened a business and a small shul, and he lived in poverty. Lived in poverty. He became a spokesman for orthodoxy against reform. He wrote many articles in Leiser's Occident. He resumed his position in 1862, but not long afterwards he died. America was a religious desert. I read at the very first lecture a quote from him in which he said he's not even sure one is allowed to live in this country Jewishly. There's nothing here. There's absolutely nothing here for a Jew. His children and his grandchildren were not observant. But I also have a footnote here, and I have a personal footnote here. I did my PhD work at the University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland. I lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I had friends in Baltimore, Maryland. And in Baltimore, I met a gentleman by the name of Shraga Phil Reis. He's a descendant, a great-grandson of Rabbi Avraham Reis. He was a Lubavitcher Chassid. Then I think he became a Satmar Chassid. But in any case, Rabbi Reis has great, great, great grandchildren who are observant. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Let's talk about the Jews in the Civil War a little bit, in a particular Grant's expulsion order. Now, Jews were on both sides of the Civil War controversy. Jews in the South owned slaves. They were all for slavery. Jews in the North were not. Alfred Mordechai, a son of Jacob Mordechai, who went to West Point at age 15 and graduated from West Point. He was a Southerner, went to West Point, graduated from West Point, became an expert in arms and was perhaps the first to develop this military science of testing weapons and how they fired. He married a woman from Philadelphia, and he was stationed in the North. When the Civil War broke out, he did not know what to do. The North wanted him because he was involved in ordnance. The South wanted him because he was involved in ordnance. If he, his relatives, his cousins, his brothers, sisters were all in the South, they were all for the South. Yet his wife and her family were for the North. Didn't know what to do. didn't know, an agonizing decision. What did he finally do? He resigned his commission in the army and sat out the entire war. Nobody liked him for it. The North didn't like him because they wanted him to fight for them. The South didn't like him because he didn't fight for them. So it gives you an idea of the tensions between Jews at that time. In any case, let's turn to Ulysses S. Grant. General Ulysses S. Grant. General Orders Number 11, Headquarters, 13th AC Department of the Tennessee, Holly Springs, December 17th, 1862. The Jews, as a class violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders, are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from the receipt of this order. Get out! Post commanders will see that all of this class of people be furnished passes and required to leave. And anyone returning after such notification will be arrested and held in confinement until an opportunity occurs of sending them out as prisoners, unless furnished with permit from headquarters. No passes will be given these people to visit headquarters for the purpose of making personal application for trade permits. By order of Major General U.S. Grant, A. Rawlins, Assistant Adjutant General. In that order, with that order, Grant expelled all of the Jews from Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi. Poof! What was going on? Why? During the Civil War, there were people who took the advantage of the situation and were making exorbitant profits when it came to supplying various materials to the soldiers, to the army, etc. And there were some Jews also involved, but it wasn't exclusively Jews by any way, shape, manner, or form. But Grant apparently thought that the Jews were the ones. And so, he decided to kick them out. Subordinates enforced the order at once in the area surrounding Grant's headquarters in Holly Springs, Mississippi. Some Jewish traders had to trudge 40 miles on foot to evacuate the area. In Paducah, Kentucky, military officials gave the town's 30 Jewish families, all long-term residents, none of them speculated, in other words, none of them involved in this military business, and at least two of them Union Army veterans, 24 hours to leave. Needless to say, this created a furor. And the idea was to get the order rescinded. And immediately a telegram was sent to President Lincoln. And it was signed by the Wolf brothers, C.F. Castell and J.W. Caswell, Caskell and J.W. Caswell. And Caesar Caskell, who was one of the signers, arrived in Washington on January 3, 1863. 2 days earlier, the Emancipation Proclamation had gone into effect. Caskell conferred with influential Jewish Republican Adolphus Solomons and then went with Cincinnati Congressman John A. Gurley directly to the White House. Lincoln received them, promptly studied Caskell's copies of General Order Number 11 and the specific order expelling Caskell from Paducah, and commanded that the order of Grant be revoked. And it was revoked 3 days later. But the Jews were expelled. It's a real blight of anti-Semitism during the Civil War. Now, Grant ran for president, of course, later. And the issue of his anti-Semitism was raised during his run for the presidency in 1868. Grant consulted with a number of Jewish communal leaders. He had supporters in the Jewish community. And they went on record saying his issuance of the General Order 11 was an anomaly and that he was not an anti-Semite. Grant claimed that Order 11 was prepared by a subordinate and he had signed it without reading it. That's what it says. What do you want? That's what it says. Oh, wait. There's more. The general carried the Jewish vote during his presidential election and maintained good relations with the Jewish community throughout his presidency. In 1874, he attended the opening of Adas Israel congregation in Washington, D.C., and stayed for the service, unlike some Jews who had left after the dedication ceremony. How about that? According to family legend, Grant ate only kosher meat during the last few years of his life. He did this after having read Vindication of the Israelitish Way of Killing Animals by Rabbi Aaron Zev Friedman. And now we'll tie into Grant by talking in conclusion about a gentleman named Rabbi Chaim Zvi Schneerson. He's 1833 to 1881, and it's his picture that I gave out. And he looks really striking to me. I think he's cool looking, and he really now... Schneerson came to America in 1870, but he had had an unusual career before that. He is a great grandson of the Bala Tanya. He's a great grandson of the Bala Tanya, Rabbi Schneer Zalman, the founder of Chabad Hasidus. He had immigrated to Palestine with his mother in 1840 at about the age of 8 and was recognized as a child prodigy. He had a classical Jewish education, but by 1860 he was traveling all over the world collecting money. When I say all over the world, Australia, China, India, Europe, everywhere. He went everywhere. Now, you have to understand, you didn't get on a plane in those days, right? It was an arduous journey. It took many months, but he went. And he collected money. He went everywhere. He went everywhere. In 1869, he met with President Ulysses S. Grant. He asked for an audience. He came to America. Came to America shortly before that. And he had on his mind a number of things that he wanted to do. And it was arranged through Jewish connections that he should meet with the president. What did he want? The first thing he wanted was the removal of the American consul in Jerusalem. Because the American consul in Jerusalem at that time was actively proselytizing amongst the Jews for Christianity. So he wanted to get rid of him. And guess what? Grant did it. He was successful. He was successful. So you see, to say that Grant was an out-and-out anti-Semite, you have to look at the whole picture. There are some nuances here. Later, he wrote Grant. He was a prolific writer. He learned English, by the way. And he wrote Grant that the situation of Jews in Romania in the 1880s, 1870s, and even later was terrible. The Jews were terribly oppressed. All of their property was taken away at one point. It was a disaster. And what Rabbi Schneerson wanted was he wanted the president to appoint a Jewish person to be the consul to Romania. And the person he wanted was Benjamin Franklin Peixoto. P-E-I-X-O-T-T-O. His grandfather was a chazan at Sheret Israel. Okay? And guess what? Grant did it. Grant did it. And Peixoto tried. He had various schemes to alleviate the condition of the Jews. He became consul to Romania. In May of 1870, he was a traveler. He started out on a cross-country tour. And he spoke in many places. In May 1870, he traveled to Cincinnati, where he told audiences that he felt he could discern the finger of God pointing to a day, not far distant, quote, he hoped, when the great deliverance would take place and the land of Israel would be restored to the Jewish people. He stressed the need to purchase land and erect buildings because the restoration would not be accomplished just by the word of God. He pointed out that Abraham, too, bought land, even though it had been divinely promised to him. He received many invitations to speak. He wrote a book. And in the book is an invitation from a very unusual source. A gentleman named Brigham Young, the founder of the Mormon Church, inviting Schneerson to speak at the Tabernacle in Salt Lake City. Yeah. Young also apparently felt that since Schneerson was known for his vision of what was going to happen vis-a-vis the end of days, that he wanted to hear from him. I do not know if Schneerson ever spoke in the Tabernacle. Ever spoke. He had one son, Moshe. He had no grandchildren that we know about. He passed away in South Africa, again, traveling all over everywhere, in either 1881 or 1882 as a young man while raising funds for the needy of Israel. A most fascinating person, in my opinion. An unusual person. a man way ahead of his time in terms of his view of the world, in terms of his willingness to try all sorts of things. In any case, we will close with Chaim Tzvi Schneerson. I thank you for your time. I just want to remind you that there is the exhibit downstairs. Also, if there are any questions, I will attempt to answer the questions. However, I will do the following. I will repeat the question so that it goes on to the recording.
Levine will handle questions.
Thank you, sir.
One of the things you notice with 19th century, even pre-World War II history of Jews in America, is that there are, for example, because of Isaac Leeser's activities, Philadelphia was a major Jewish center up until fairly recently. There's still a yeshiva there. In Cincinnati, because of the work of Isaac Mayer Weiss, but Cincinnati was a center. Why do you think New York overwhelmingly, it reached a point where New York overwhelmingly overshadowed everything else in America? There's New York and then everywhere else.
The question is, why did New York overshadow everything in America? By the way, I don't know if you're aware, but there was, during the 19th century, it was a question whether Hoboken would be the main port on the Atlantic coast or New York. It's not so clear. I think what sort of turned the tide was the huge immigration. 2 million Jews left Eastern Europe as a result of pogroms and other anti-Semitic proclamations of the Tsar and came to America, and the overwhelming majority of them came to New York City.
Again, but why stop New York?
Because New York, first of all, there was what was an industrial center. New York was a port. New York was where they had relatives. And who wanted to go in the boondock? How come today people live in New York? We're crazy to live here. There's all sorts of reasons not to live in New York, but there are plenty of reasons to live in New York. Okay? New York has a certain attraction. It is, well, the mayor says it's the center of the world, so I wouldn't argue with him, I guess. Yes, anybody else?
Did Crescent have any relationship with Lev Ivry at that time, who also had similar ideas in 1920?
I don't recall whether he had other, he had any relations with other proto-Zionists. I just don't know. I don't recall anymore. Specifically?
No, the Chav Beit Zion.
I don't know. I don't think he had any connection with the Chav Beit Zion. I don't think he... Pardon?
It was at that time.
What was at that time?
The Chav Beit Zion.
No, the Chav Beit Zion is in the latter part of the 19th century, and there's a nice picture on the internet. If you email me, I will send you the link, in which you can see the secret society of Chav Beit Zion in the Volozhin Yeshiva. And sitting amongst the gentlemen is somebody by the name of Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who later became Rosh Yeshiva in Slabodka. We can't put that in an art scroll book. We can't. The Netziv supported it, yes. Of course, once they saw, again, there were attempts, the religious Jews thought that they could steer Zionism within a religious framework. But once it became clear that that was not going to happen, many of them broke with it. Max Nordau, I think is his name, who was a friend of Herzl's, was married to a Christian woman. And he wrote Herzl that he was concerned what would happen once the state is founded, how would his marriage to his wife be viewed? And Herzl wrote him back, "We will never let the clerics tell us what to do. We will never." By the way, I don't know if you're aware, but Herzl proposed at one point in his life the mass conversion of European Jewry. He proposed it to the Pope. He was going to lead it. Okay? Yes, I'm sorry. Maybe I shattered a Zionistic dream there, but what can I say? Sir?
Any idea of the intermarriage rate during this period of history?
Do I have any idea of the intermarriage rate? I don't have any hard statistics, but for example, I spent some time, I became interested in this Mordechai family, Jacob Mordechai, etc. And when you read a couple of the books and you see what happened, it was astounding. But let's even earlier, the Frank family, the Franks, which, they're colonial family, and within three generations there were no Jews left. There were no Jews left in the family. And first of all, there were two things going on amongst the Sephardim. The Sephardim in America were the elite class. They looked down upon the Germans. It's very interesting. They felt the Germans were uncouth, and many of them, rather than marry a German Jew, either didn't marry or married a Gentile. Now, what is ironic is that when the Eastern European Jews began to come here, and the German Jews had attained a certain status in America as Jews, they looked down upon the Eastern European Jews and didn't want anything to do with them. So history repeats itself. Maybe one more question and then we'll... Or if that's it, that's it. Okay, I thank you so much. Have a good evening.